In Hebrews, the 12th chapter, we want to begin our study in verse 18. But before we do that, let's enumerate the things that are found in the previous chapters. In chapter 1, Jesus is better than what? Carolyn? Randy, help her out. Chapter 1. The prophets and then the angels in the second part of chapter 1. Better than the prophets and better than the angels in the second part of chapter 1. In chapter 2, he's better than the angels. In chapter 3, Ken, better than Moses. In chapter 4, we see a warning. What's the warning? Well, a little bit later. That's in 5. In the fourth chapter, we see the let us statements. Right. Let us statements. Let us fear lest we fail to enter into the promised rest. And then in the fourth chapter, the 14th verse, I really wanted to emphasize verses 14 through verse 16 because it tells us that we have a high priest that can be approached, one that hath been tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. And then in verse 16, he says, let us therefore draw near with boldness unto the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help us in time of need. Again, I want to emphasize that we can draw near unto one who has been tempted in all points like as we are. Draw near, we don't have to stand off like we're going to be discussing in the 12th chapter that the Jews did when they received the law. And then, David, in the 5th chapter, we see in verse 11, there's an interruption to the discussion of the priesthood with what thought? All right. They've not matured as they should. And that thought continues through the 6th chapter, where the writer paints an awful picture of those who have obeyed the gospel and then fell away, how that it is impossible to renew certain of them again unto repentance, seeing they crucified to themselves the Son of God afresh. And then in the latter part of the 6th chapter, the thought returns to the priesthood of Christ after the order of Melchizedek. And then in chapter 7, the priesthood of Christ after the order of Melchizedek continues to be discussed, the old and the new priesthood. And then in the 8th chapter, we have the old and the new what? Covenant being discussed. And then in the 9th chapter, we have the old and the new emblems or tabernacle or elements of the tabernacle. Old and new emblems, if you please. And then in the 10th chapter, what's being discussed? All right, it's a shadow. The law is a shadow of things to come. And we see sanctification through the one offering, the blood of Christ, offered one time for the sins of many. And then in the 11th chapter, what's the theme? Great hall of faith. Great heroes that we read about. And then in the 12th chapter, we're told about focusing our sight on... Pardon me? Upon heaven. That's right. Jesus, the author and finisher or perfecter of our faith. And then we see a discussion of the chastening of the Lord. And that's in the realm, I think, of providence. It's difficult for me to always know when something is a result of God's providence. And it's difficult for me to always know when something is a part of God's chastening. But the lesson is, there are lessons that we can take home from suffering. And James tells us in chapter 1, I believe it is, to count it all joy when you fall into manifold temptations, and indicates the benefits that we might receive through temptation. Now, in the 18th verse of the 12th chapter, the writer identifies what we have not come unto. He says, for ye are not come unto a mount that might be touched and that burned with fire, and unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that no word more should be spoken unto them. For they could not endure that which was enjoined. Even if a beast touched the mountain, it should be stoned. And so fearful was the appearance that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. The writer has talked about laying aside the things that hinder in the first part of the 12th chapter. He's talked about the need to run the race with endurance. He's talked about keeping our eyes focused. He's talked about the Lord's chastening. He's talked about discouragement in verses 12 and 13, how that we are to lift up our hands. And then he talks about pursuing peace and holiness in verses 12 or verses 14 through essentially verse 17. And now he's talking about those things that we have not come unto. We have not come unto the mount that characterized the giving of the law. It is not Mount Sinai that we've come unto, that was characterized with all of these horrible things that frightened the people and even made Moses afraid. We have not come unto a mountain that forces us by boundary to remain far away from the Lord. But he says, beginning at verse 22, "But ye are come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable hosts of angels." He begins to outline what we have come unto. But when he suggests that we have come unto Mount Zion, he says that we have come to something that is encouraging us to draw near, giving us the hope of heaven, the heavenly city, the city of the living God, the new Jerusalem. Now, we've studied in the 11th chapter already, as we noted the character and the faith of Abraham. In verse 10, it told us, or tells us, that he looked for the city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. In verses 13 through verse 16, he speaks of these great characters of faith, chapter 11. "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things make it manifest that they are seeking after a country of their own. And if indeed they had been mindful of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city." Now the Hebrew writer in the 12th chapter says, "You've not come unto that which is earthly, but you've come unto the heavenly city, the city of Jerusalem, the city that was longed for by Abraham, the city that you can belong to." As we look in the 13th chapter in verse 14, he says, "For we have not here an abiding city, but we seek after the city which is to come." The writer is telling us in a very enthusiastic way that you've not come unto something that should cause you to fear to draw near, but you've come unto something that is obtainable. This heavenly city is where the Lord dwells. It is our eternal home. And in coming to Christ, we have come into a covenant relationship which gives us the right to a place in that city. So it's an honorable thing that the writer says you've come into the city of the living God. But he also says you have come to the innumerable company, as it were, of angels, the innumerable host of angels. What does that suggest to us? When you've drawn near unto God, what have you drawn near unto?
City.
All right, that city, the heavenly city, where God is.
With all those other families.
That's right.
The angels.
That's right. The heavenly servants of God. You get to draw near to that and be a part of that. The throne of God, surrounded by hosts of angels. And then he says, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, enrolled in heaven. Again, what have you come unto? You become a part of the church universal, as it were, those who are redeemed, those who are saved, those whose names are written or enrolled in heaven, those who are written in the Lamb's book of life, as the writer Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 3. You've come to the judge of all, he tells us. The judge of all the earth, Genesis chapter 18, verse 25, tells us. And you remember in our study on Sunday morning in Romans chapter 2, verse 16, that God is referred to as the one who judges even the secret things of men. So you've come to the honorable judge of all the earth. And then as he continues this thought, he says, you have come to the spirits of just men made perfect in verse 23. The just men made perfect are those that are described in the 11th chapter. And in verses 39 and 40, those whose faith has been perfected through the sacrifice of Christ. It says, and these all, having had witness borne to them through their faith, receive not the promise, God having provided some better thing concerning us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. In other words, they will be made perfect with us. So those Old Testament worthies that are described in the 11th chapter shall be made perfect with us. So we have the privilege of being in the presence of the spirits of just men made perfect. But also in the 24th verse, he says, "You have come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to blood of sprinkling that speaketh better than that of Abel." You've come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. The writer spent a whole chapter, the 8th chapter, talking about the benefits of the new covenant versus those things that existed under the old covenant, and how that under the new covenant, our sins are remembered no more. We've come to the mediator, he says, of a new covenant. Jesus identified in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 5 as being both man and God, himself the mediator between man and God. You've come to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better than that of Abel. I believe in our last study we talked about that which Abel's blood cried out for. And according to Genesis chapter 4, what did his blood cry out for? Vengeance, that's right. But the blood of Christ, by comparison, cries out for
mercy,
forgiveness, that's right. And then he says in verse 25, very importantly, he says, "See that ye refuse not him that speaketh." Now that takes us back, I believe, to Hebrews the first chapter and the very first verse, as it tells us that God, having of old time spoken unto the fathers and the prophets by divers portions and in divers manners, hath at the end of these days spoken unto us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things. He has spoken. We need not and must not refuse him that speaks to us. God speaks to us today through his Son. The Old Testament book of Genesis in the 18th chapter, Moses said in verse 18, that's not the passage I'm looking for, it's Deuteronomy. Yes, Deuteronomy 18, verse 18. Moses said, "I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him." Who is God's prophet today? Jesus is. God speaks to us through Jesus. We notice that the Apostle Peter in Acts chapter 3, beginning in verse 22, identified that prophet as Jesus, the one through whom he speaks. We must listen. God speaks to us today through Jesus, not through Moses. In fact, as we turn in our New Testament to Matthew the 17th chapter, and read in the first few verses of Matthew 17, we read of the scene of the Transfiguration where Jesus was with Moses and Elijah. And you remember in that instance, Peter said, "It is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us build three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And about that time, a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." What's the significance of the appearance of Moses and the prophet Elijah there with Jesus?
Moses was for the Old Testament, and Elijah was signified all the prophets.
That's right. Moses represented the giving of the law. Elijah represented God speaking through the prophets. And now he says, "This is my Son, hear him." Yes, Joey? Yes.
Kind of thing as a transition, you know, from the old to the new.
That's right. That's right. God did speak through Moses and the prophets. Now he speaks through Christ.
Does that verse, chapter 25, does Hebrews 10, 28 through 30 have anything to do with that?
Hebrews 10, 28 through 30, in reference to verse 25? Yes, I believe so. Yes, as the rest of this verse tells us, when you refuse him that speaketh, there are consequences. And just as we saw in Hebrews 10, willful sin resulted in consequences. In fact, if we'll go back to chapter 10, verse 26 through 28, those who rejected Moses' law died without compassion. They died without mercy. And if we go back just a little further, in Hebrews the 3rd chapter and in verse 17, we notice that those who sinned during the period of the wilderness wandering, their bodies fell in the wilderness. And then as we go back one more chapter to Hebrews chapter 2, we notice in verse 2 that every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward. So we've seen the analogy under the law. Now under the law of Christ, under the terms of the new covenant, under Him that speaketh to us today, God's prophet today, in chapter 2 verse 1, the writer says, "How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation?" Well, if He did not allow those who lived under the law to escape, shall He much more allow us to escape? Well, no. And then in chapter 10, verse 26 through 31, He points out, "Of how much worse or sorer punishment think ye shall He be judged worthy, who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God, and counted the blood of the covenant wherewith He was sanctified an unholy thing, and done despite unto the Spirit of grace." Dale? The vision on the mountain, they saw Peter, James, and John, heard God speak to them, saying, "This is My Son, hear Him."
So, he's being charged and crucified for claiming to be the King of the Jews or being the Son of God?
Yes. And those things would culminate after the resurrection and be preached by the apostles. The word of Christ would begin to be preached in Acts 2. Remember, just before Jesus ascended, He said, "All power in heaven and on earth has been given unto Me." Matthew 28, beginning in verse 18. That power was preached in Acts 2 as Peter declared the exaltation of Jesus to the right hand of God.
Was not Jesus referred to as the Son of God prior to
that? Oh, yes. In fact, He was referred to as the Son of God even by way of prophecy. In Isaiah chapter 9, I believe it is, beginning about verse 6, He was referred to as the Son of God.
Wasn't it preached that He was the Son of God? Was it preached before the crucifixion?
That He was the Son of God, that's right. Even Jesus Himself claimed to be the Son of God a number of times in the Gospel of John. In fact, that was one of the purposes for which John wrote, to show signs that Jesus had performed, that you might know that He is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in His name. So yes, to answer your question. But not only then, that was the message that the apostles preached. They preached salvation through the Son of God. Okay? Through His blood. I believe we had Randy and then Joey. Right.
And then he did in 2 Peter chapter 1, he recounts it in verse 16. He says, "We did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of His majesty. But when he received honor and glory from God the Father, such an utterance as this was made to Him by majestic glory, 'This is My beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased.'"
That's right. Good.
"And we ourselves heard this utterance made from heaven.
He bore eyewitness to it." That's right. That's right. Good. Appreciate you noting that passage. Very appropriate to the question that Dale asked. Yes?
Even the Lord's deity was referred to in name at His birth as well, when it says that He shall be called Emmanuel, and translated that means God with us.
That's right.
There's another reference to His name showing deity at His birth. So,
well, that's right. Going to have a study, I was mentioning to Ken Friday night with someone, likely we'll discuss that, the deity of Christ, and that'll likely be a passage we'll obviously refer to. But in this instance of Hebrews chapter 12, we're talking about God's prophet. God's prophet must not be rejected. Verse 25, see that ye refuse not him that speaketh. For if they escape not when they refused him that warneth them on earth, much more shall not we escape who turn away from him that warneth from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more will I make to tremble not the earth only, but also the heaven. They were not permitted to escape when they rejected God speaking through Moses. Much more, we will not escape if we reject God speaking through Christ. There are consequences and were consequences under the law for those who rejected Moses, and there are consequences for those who reject Christ. Now in verse 26, I want you to feel free to talk with me about this, because my mind is not entirely clear on a question or two that I've raised. It says, whose voice then shook the earth. Well, of course we know that was the giving of the law, and as we've discussed from Deuteronomy chapter 9, I believe it was, or 19 it was, when the law was given, it was a terrifying experience. But in verse 26 it continues, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more will I make to tremble not the earth only, but also the heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifies the removing of those things, etc. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But what we see in verse 26 is a quotation from the Old Testament text of Haggai chapter 2, verse 6. And in Haggai chapter 2, the writer is talking about the reconstruction of the temple under Haggai and Zerubbabel. And God said that he would shake the nations and make them make their treasures flow into the temple and make the temple rebuilt with splendor. Now, that's the essence of the context of Haggai chapter 2. But my question is, what application does that have to that which we have come unto in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 26? I have an idea, but I want to hear what you have to say. Daryl?
Could you explain the situation?
Haggai chapter 2, the writer is talking about the reconstruction of the temple during the days of Haggai and Zerubbabel, and the splendor of that temple as it would have the resources from the nations, as it were. You remember when Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, had conquered essentially the known world and then allowed the Jews to go home. He had the resources of the nations and sent Haggai was sent back to rebuild the temple or the walls around the temple. Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple. That's the context of Haggai chapter 2. So my question is, what's the application of that to our text? David?
Well, I think it's showing a better temple. Just like it's been doing all the comparisons. I think the reference of Haggai, the foreshadowing of Christ, of his covenant, him being the temple of us being the temple of God.
Okay, I think that's right. And the things that are being removed, what were those things? The old law and all that pertained unto it, including, I believe, the temple that existed in Jerusalem. Joey, and then Randy and David.
Do you think there's any chance that, again, 26 and 27 are referring to perhaps the end of the world?
There's certainly an application of that in 2 Peter 3.
He's showing the superiority of the spiritual kingdom over the physical earth.
Yeah.
The physical earth will be destroyed, but that spiritual kingdom, heaven, will remain. It will endure.
Yeah. I've thought of that in 2 Peter 3, 9 and 10, but it seems to me to stretch the context of this passage to make application to that. Though that point is true, this passage is talking about those things that were given on Mount Sinai versus those things that we have. Not necessarily those things that are yet to come, but those things that we have come into.
I'm sorry.
No, not. I wouldn't rule out the possibility.
Would you rule out the possibility that we have maybe a dual meaning here?
Well, perhaps. Yeah, that's perhaps true. Where did I get to? Randy?
I would have said.
Okay, David?
Well, you know, I think it is talking about the spiritual nature, but I think as a new covenant, we have a more spiritual nature than the old covenant. I mean, they have
certainly
physical sacrifices, they have physical things they have to do, but ours is spiritual. I think it's talking about that.
Yeah. I think so. David?
Perhaps Daniel 2:44. And in those days these kings shall the God of heaven set up the kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these nations, and it shall stand forever.
Certainly the kingdom that these Hebrews were becoming a part of is the kingdom of Daniel 2:44. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit some more. Terry? My thoughts are in verse 26 and 27 that those things that are shaken has to do with the removal of all that pertain to that old covenant. Which would include the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, the temple, and all that pertained to it.
At about verse 10 or 11, you see...
We have an altar.
You see that the temple at this time, the Jewish system, still exists.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At this point in time.
And that takes us back, I believe, to the 8th chapter, where as he talks about the new covenant versus the old, he says, but that which is becoming old and waxeth aged is nigh unto vanishing away. Now, that old covenant was no longer effective, but yet we see that the temple was still in place. The sacrifices and so forth were still in place, but they were to be done away. Randy and then David. And Dale, I thought I saw your hand. Okay. Let me get David and then back to you.
Where I see that, though, is what Terry was just talking about.
Yeah.
That in verse 27, yet once more denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken as of created things.
Okay.
Well, the temple was created.
That's right. It was a part of that, which, yeah.
Put up by men.
That's right.
And it was torn down by men.
That's right. That's right.
History.
Yeah.
Soon to be
history.
At the point
yeah.
This was written, it was soon
yeah.
to be history.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And he was comforting them and saying, you know, even after that happens, you still have a kingdom that cannot be shaken.
That's right. The 7th chapter in verses 11 and 12 that talks about the replacing of the priesthood, I think has application to this. David, and then I'll come back to Dale, and then I'll pick you up, Terry. Dale's had his hand up for a moment.
I was going to mention that it says yet once more. And it's been comparing the old and new. We had God shaking the Mount Sinai in the area there when he introduced the old covenant or the first covenant. Then this one is talking about, I think, this one, the new covenant coming in.
Yeah.
That's the shaking and the temple being tore down. All the old emblems will be done away with. And that's a shame because Jesus was the bridge from the old to the new.
All right.
He's the bridge. He's the in-between.
Okay.
So I think it's, you know, and I do think it's talking about spiritual. That, you know, Joe's talking about that. I think it's spiritual, and the spiritual will continue and last on. And like I said, I think the new covenant is spiritual. But
yeah.
I was just talking about the very end of the second covenant.
Okay. I want to have a comment on that in just a moment. Dale? Pardon me? Okay, what my comment was is those things that are physical in nature pertain to, I believe, this old covenant and all that pertained unto it. But yet we find that these have come into a kingdom that cannot be shaken. As David was pointing out from verse 28, kingdoms of men, even the earth itself, can be destroyed. But the kingdom that we have become a part of will never be shaken. The kingdom that these Hebrews were becoming a part of cannot be shaken. It cannot be destroyed. And so the kingdoms of men, even those associated with the law and the old covenant and the temple and Jerusalem, that kingdom would be shaken down to its roots. But the kingdom of Christ will never be shaken. Go ahead. That's true.
Everything else, all the corruption, all the evil, all the other faith that you just can't get through, you can't help these people. Like, I don't want to say Noah's Ark, for instance, but that's the closest I can come to think of is, you know, wipe everything out and start over with what's right and try again with the true faith.
Well, though that's true, I think in Daniel chapter 2, as David was pointing out a while ago, in verse 44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The sovereignty thereof will not be left to another people, but it'll break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever, Daniel said. I think that's the kingdom that's being talked about here that was established in Acts chapter 2, that these, by faith, were becoming a part of, and they were becoming a part of something that was permanent as opposed to that which could be shaken or destroyed. Terry, did I wait so long to get to you? You forgot your comment? Right.
In a very short term here, when Hebrews was written.
That's right. And keeping in mind that Hebrews was written around 65 A.D. and the city of Jerusalem was utterly destroyed in 70 A.D. And I think the promise here is that you have become a part of something that will not be shaken like Jerusalem will. I think when we look back into Matthew 24, we see the indications, and we're going to have to talk about that a little bit later when we get over to the, even in this context, as it talks about those things that are shaken, the terms that are used. If you'll turn back to Matthew 24 and notice beginning in the verse that's at the top of the left-hand page in the left-hand column. Sounds about right. No, not quite there. beginning about verse 29. It says, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. And they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send forth his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." And then he continues on down through the next few verses. But the imagery here has to do, I believe, with judgment. Judgment upon the city of Jerusalem. We see the same kind of language used in Isaiah 13 concerning the destruction of Babylon, and in Ezekiel chapter 32 concerning the destruction of the nation of Egypt. Those terms are fascinating to me and gave me a whirl in my thinking for a while. But in the context of Matthew 24, they have to have application to the physical destruction of the city of Jerusalem. The reason I said that is in verse 34, it says of Matthew 24, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished." Those things that are discussed in the previous verses would have to take place in this generation. And the terminology is used in Old Testament text to describe the destruction of nations. There was a long time when I thought that the language of Matthew 24, 29 through 31 had to do with the second coming of Christ. But it won't fit this context. It just won't fit this context when you determine that all these things will come together or come to pass upon this generation. How is it then that these things identified in verses 29 through 31 will come to pass upon that generation if they're talking about the second coming of Christ? Randy? The righteous in the city of Jerusalem.
That would be who the Hebrews letter, the Hebrew letter is talking to. The kingdom of God in Jerusalem.
Well, the Hebrew Christians, yeah, those who are a part of the church are those Hebrew Christians to whom the Hebrew letter is addressed.
When he says they will gather together his elect from the four winds, and one in the sky to the other.
Yeah. Well, the context of Matthew 24, whatever the meaning of that is, would occur in that generation. And certainly the judgment that's spoken of in Matthew 24 is not a universal judgment. It has to do with the destruction of the city of Jerusalem when you would see the abomination of desolation as Daniel describes. And as Luke, I believe it is, in chapter 21, in his explanation of that, tells us that that would be when you see the armies surround the city. So he's obviously talking about the city of Jerusalem and destruction that would come upon that. That's why I think that Hebrews chapter 12, when he talks about those things being shaken, he's talking about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem being removed out of its place, the temple being destroyed, and all of those things that pertain to that Old Testament system being removed. And these Hebrews were becoming a part of something that could not be shaken, could not be removed. Go ahead, Terry.
Randy might look back in his memory and think about our discussions in class on Daniel chapter 12, verse 1.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. There the writer is talking about temporal judgment. Okay. Roy.
What year was,
pardon me?
What year was
70 AD. And this letter was written about 65, just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. Judy and then David. I think so. Let's go back to Matthew 24 and then turn from there and note the language. Let me put my marker there. The language used in Isaiah chapter 13. It's almost parallel. In Isaiah chapter 13, reading beginning in verse 10. You'll notice in the context, verse 1, it says, "The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see." So he's talking about the destruction or the fall of Babylon. And then as he begins to discuss the fall of Babylon in verse 10, he says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not shine, or shall not cause its light to shine." You see similar language that's used in the destruction of Babylon. The same thing in Ezekiel 32 regarding the destruction of Egypt. And why that language is used, I think, is to impress us with the horror of such a destruction. One of the things I think you see, even in the country where we live, in Southern California, when you see a forest fire like those that have been in the spring and summertime in this area. The sun doesn't look quite like the sun because of the smoke. And we see that in destruction of nations and destruction of cities, they were often set on fire to destroy them. David and then Ken.
Well, I was just going to say the Jews that he's writing to need this comfort, need this reassurance, because it's going to shake them even though they're Jewish Christian. When the temple is destroyed, Jerusalem is destroyed, utterly destroyed, that's going to be a big blow to even Jewish Christians.
Oh, yes. It'll rattle their cage.
Right. And
they, yeah.
And they need to know that what they became a part of will not be shaken down, even though the whole city is.
Yeah, I think that's right. Ken?
Well, I don't believe it does any harm one way or the other, whether it's referring to the end of time or not.
No.
We do know the end of time, the earth is going to shake and the heavens too.
Yeah. So all be destroyed.
Whether this verse is saying now, it will say in Revelation chapter 20.
Yeah.
So we understand it, so there's really no argument that anyone would have to make.
Well, that's right. Not particularly. I just think that it's having in this context to do with the old and the new law. Now, the application of it is true either way you go. Yeah. Yes. Showing the greatness of what they've become a part of as opposed to what they've left. Don't go back to something inferior. Okay? Any other questions or comments? Let's look then again at verse 28. He says, "Wherefore receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken." This kingdom that is prophesied in Daniel chapter 2, one that would break in pieces and consume all others and stand forever, is obviously the kingdom that these Hebrews were becoming a part of. And the reason why I say that is the characteristics are the same. If the kingdom that these Hebrews were becoming a part of is not the kingdom of Daniel chapter 2, then what will become of the kingdom in Hebrews chapter 12 that cannot be shaken when one comes, according to Daniel 2, that's going to break in pieces and consume all others? You've got God against God. Either way you go with that. So the kingdom of Daniel 2 has to be the kingdom of Hebrews chapter 12 that these Hebrews were becoming a part of. They were becoming a part of that which was eternal. Now, any questions or comments just there? Yes, Joy? Well, certainly.
Take advantage of what Christ has done for them. How offensive that must be to God. And I guess the point I'm making is we need to really value what God has done for us.
Well, certainly.
And not take it lightly, because it's the greatest gift God could give anybody is eternal life.
Well, that's right. And of course, the Hebrew writer points that out to these Hebrews to help them to understand. Don't go back to something that's inferior. He says,
this last verse is God is a consuming fire.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, it's the first we're talking about. But I mean, the idea there is, you want him
Yeah.
Not want to be at odd ends.
That's right. You don't want him as an adversary. And you certainly want him as a friend. All right? In Hebrews chapter 10, we've already noted in verse 29, he tells us what you've done when you reject the things that he's offered us. You've trodden underfoot the Son of God. You've counted the blood of the covenant an unholy thing. You've done despite or despised the Spirit of grace. Yes, these are horrible things that we do when we reject the gospel and reject the plan that God has revealed. Yes. True.
For the most part, at least the scriptures show that people saw the true tire without still rejecting it, but
certainly.
In this world, yeah, it's a matter of lack of effort to study and find out in ignorance, but God says that that ignorance will not be an excuse.
Well, that's right. In verse 28, the writer continues, "Let us have grace whereby we may offer service well pleasing to God with reverence and awe." God is described in verse 29, Joey, as a consuming fire. Now, other passages in Hebrews describe him as one who issues fiery indignation and will devour the adversaries, Hebrews 10, as we've studied in verse 27. We've already noted in Hebrews 10, verse 31, that it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And in our studies recently from Romans chapter 11 and in verse 22, we've noted the goodness and the severity of God. And then we've studied in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 11, knowing the terror of the Lord, Paul persuaded men. Yes.
In verse 28, wherefore receiving the kingdom that cannot be shaken, that's pretty interesting because the answer is let us have grace whereby we may be able to offer service well-pleasing to God with reverence and awe. You know, I'm thinking that you might be right what you were saying before, because that is our objective, is to fear Him and reverence Him and give Him service on earth.
That's right.
I think that kingdom is what you were saying before. Yeah. That kind of adds up.
Yeah, it makes sense. So we offer service to Him that's well-pleasing with reverence and awe. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 12 and 13, we learn that the whole of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. And the reason is we will stand before Him and give an account of the things we've done in this life, whether they be good or whether they be bad. David?
Yeah, I was reading this. We talked about in Isaiah 33:14, you know, the Assyrians were wiped out, 185,000 one night, woke up the next morning, 185,000. Dead, but the people of Zion, it says in verse 14, the sinners of Zion are afraid, trembling, as seized the godless ones. So people who are in Jerusalem that were sinners, godless ones, maybe they rejected God, they see that. Now they're afraid. So
that's right.
A good visual aid.
A very good visual aid.
God is that fire, and when we see, you know, the examples in the Bible, Gomorrah, all that stuff, that should make us fear.
That's right. God has spoken, and we must listen. Randy?
There's a reference back in Deuteronomy chapter 4 when Moses was exhorting Israel to obey God. Verse 23, "So watch yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which He made with you, and make for yourselves a graven image in the form of anything against which the Lord your God has commanded you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it continues in the reprimand.
Right.
And there's a promise that, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you, that you shall surely perish quickly from the land where you're going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live on it, but be utterly destroyed."
That's right. The judgment of God is real. And so we need to stand before Him in reverence and awe. All right. Enjoy the class.